So it's the 25th of March, 2019 in Brisbane, and we're going to be going through the 66th chapter of the 10th canto, which is the story of Pundraka, the king of Kasi, and the Sudakshina. So, at this time, Balaram is away in Vrindavan. What's he doing in Vrindavan?
Going to meet the family?
Yeah. Any idea, anybody remember some of the things Balaram does when he visits Vrindavan?
Meets the family and meets all the other gopis,
Yes, he has his own gopis, he dances with them, and does he kill a demon? There's a demon he kills. You kids know what demon Balaram kills when he dances with the gopis?
Vidvita,
yeah. And what happens when he's... Why don't you guys stop coloring? What happens when he kills Vidvita? This is a story class, you'll like it. What happens when he kills Vidvita? What does he use to kill Vidvita?
His hand.
Eventually his hand. What did they use first?
Trees.
And eventually there were no more...
Trees.
And then they were using what?
Stones,
mountaintops. So Balaram was away in Vrindavan, and there was Pundraka. He was the king of Kurusha. And he thought, I'm going to challenge Krishna now when Balaram's not there. I have a good opportunity. Krishna's going to be weak because Balaram's not there. So he sent a messenger. And the messenger went to Dwarka and said, my master Pundraka is actually God. And Sukadeva Goswami says that he was just being flattered by foolish people. You know, if people come up to you and say, you're wonderful, and then you believe you're wonderful. So people would go to Pundraka and say, you're God, and so he believed that he was God. Prabhupada said it was like children who play that they're a king. You know, some child plays I'm a king, and then they actually believe that they're a king. So Sukadeva Goswami two times says that Pundraka sent a messenger to Dwarka. And the acharyas say he said it two times because he just couldn't even believe it. It's like Pundraka sent a messenger to Dwarka. Pundraka actually sent a messenger to Dwarka because he just couldn't believe that Pundraka would send a messenger to see Krishna to say, you know, I'm actually Vasudev, not you. So Krishna's in the royal assembly and he's hearing this message. The messenger says, my master Pundraka is the real Vasudev. You, Krishna, are the imposter. So recently I was hearing a story, a true story, of this very, very famous actor who was going to get his car fixed. And he's waiting in the garage while the mechanics are fixing his car. And one of the mechanics goes up to him and says, you look just like that famous actor. Oh. And the guy says, well, I am actually that actor. He says, no, I don't believe you. But you look just like him. And he says, no, really, I am. And he gets out his driver's license and stuff. And the more the actor tried to prove to the mechanic that he was the real actor, the more the mechanic thought that the man was lying. He kept saying, oh, no, you're not the actor. But you look like him. So here's this messenger from Pundraka saying that Pundraka is the real God and Krishna's the fake one. So the messenger tells Krishna, give up your name. Give up your fake name. And give me all your weapons. So what are Krishna's weapons? Sudarshan. And Sudarshan Chakra, what else? His club. It's just interesting, in Melbourne we were reading this verse by Prithu Maharaj, and he's describing how by logic we can know that there's a God, and by following the Mahajanas we can know that there's a God, and God has a club. It was the only personal thing he said about God, that God has a club. So he has his disc and his club. Any other weapons? Yeah, it's a bow. He's showing the bow. Right? And sometimes his conch shell and his lotus are considered weapons too. And with Lord Chaitanya, his associates are considered weapons. So that'd be us, that we're Lord Chaitanya's weapons. So the messenger said, give me your weapons and come and take my shelter. Imagine, you know, talking to the Lord. Okay, why don't you take my shelter? So that's what he was saying. Now, the Acharyas say that actually what Pandraka was saying, when he said to Krishna, give up your name, he was saying to Krishna, take away my false designation. And he was saying, give me your weapons. He was really saying, take away all my fake weapons and liberate me by killing me. So everybody was laughing and laughing and laughing. And Krishna was really enjoying how all of his devotees were laughing. So I was thinking about this. Here's this foolish Pandraka, and he's making Krishna happy by getting everybody to laugh. Right? That's one of the rasas, the hasya rasa, the comedy rasa. So Pandraka is actually giving a comedy show for Krishna with this messenger. And you know, we hear about from Rupa Goswami, what is bhakti? Anukulenya, the bhakti is favorable to Krishna. And so it's very interesting because someone like Kamsa makes Krishna happy by fighting with him, but it's not considered bhakti. And Mother Yasoda makes Krishna angry. When does Mother Yasoda make Krishna angry? Oh, even before that.
Drops him for the milk.
When she puts him down. Oh, she doesn't drop him, but when she... she doesn't drop him. When she puts him down to go take care of the milk, Krishna gets very angry. So Kamsa made Krishna happy and Yasoda made Krishna angry. So it seems like Kamsa is doing favorable service and Yasoda is doing unfavorable service. But actually Yasoda's intention is to make Krishna happy and Kamsa's intention is to kill Krishna. So what Yasoda does is considered bhakti and what Kamsa does is not considered bhakti. But still, the demons still give Krishna happiness. So this demon made Krishna happy because Krishna was enjoying seeing all his friends. And then Krishna sends a message back with the messenger. He said, I will give you all my weapons by throwing them at you on the battlefield. And then he said, you're not going to be my shelter. You're only going to be the shelter of vultures and dogs. So the messenger goes back to Pandraka and gives him this message. And Pandraka very patiently is listening to this message. And in the meantime, Krishna decides he's going to attack him. So Krishna took this message as basically an invitation to war, or as an attack on him. So he gets his army together. Now, although Pandraka was the king of Kurusha, he wasn't in Kurusha at the time. He was in Kasi. He was with his friend Kasiraj, the king of Kasi. So Krishna took his own chariot to Kashi. And with his army, he surrounded the whole city. So this is what happens when you challenge God. Right? He comes to attack your whole city. So Pandraka comes out with two Akshohini divisions, which is a lot of soldiers and horses and elephants. And then the king of Kashi comes out with three more. Now we're going to see here what happens when you make friends with the wrong people. So Kashi, the king of Kashi really suffers here by throwing in his lot with Pandraka. So now Krishna sees Pandraka for the first time. Now, I find this statement very interesting. How can Krishna see anybody for the first time? How does that make any sense? Krishna has seen everybody forever. Right? And even if you're just going to talk about this life, Krishna is seeing everybody. Krishna's eyes and ears and hands and legs are everywhere, and he sees everything all of the time. So how can we say that Krishna sees somebody for the first time? Of course, it's very interesting. In Krishna's Leela, we have, you know, like Radha and Krishna meet for the first time, or Rukmini and Krishna meet for the first time. Now, Rukmini and Krishna are always married. They're eternally married, and yet they have a wedding. Right, now sometimes in this world, people who are married, they may have a renewal of vows, where they have another like little mini wedding. You've ever heard that?
25.
A 25th anniversary, yeah. My daughter did that on their 10th wedding anniversary. She and her husband dressed up in the same clothes they wore for their wedding, and they exchanged garlands again. I mean, they didn't invite anybody. I don't think they invited anybody. They made cake. You know, so sometimes people have like a renewal of the wedding at a 10th or 25th or whatever, 50th wedding anniversary. But Krishna and Rukmini actually get married over and over again, and Sita and Ram, like they're seeing each other for the first time, because it's such an exciting thing to see somebody for the first time. So Krishna likes to experience that. So he has these pastimes where things are going on eternally, and yet they're happening for the first time. It's explained that whenever Krishna has his pastimes, he always thinks that they're happening for the first time, even though they're repeating. Which I found really interesting, because at first when I heard that Krishna's pastimes are eternal and they're happening over and over again, I thought, well, that would be boring. You know, how many times are you going to go through? Then you already know how it's going to end. Oh, I remember this pastime. And Krishna goes in the snake and he gets really big. And in fact, I had one devotee telling me, she teaches children's classes, and she says, you know, they always need to hear new stories, because when they hear the same stories again, they say, oh, we know that story, it's boring. And I thought, well, you must not have people telling it very well, right? If you think like that. So we should tell stories so that people are thinking, wow, I'm really hearing this for the first time. So Krishna was feeling like that, you know, I'm seeing Pandraka for the first time. And of course, this is also because when Krishna comes to this planet in his Leela, he's not exactly acting like he's God. This is his human-like pastimes. He's acting like he's a human. So he saw Pandraka for the first time in his role as a human. It's as God that he was seeing him all the time. You understand? Right? So as God, all-pervasive, and in everyone's heart, he had seen Pandraka forever. And in this life, he'd seen him, you know, as soon as he was born. But as Krishna playing his Leela, he actually saw him for the first time. And when Krishna saw him, Krishna saw that Pandraka had how many arms?
Four.
Now, were the other arms real arms?
No.
No. They were just fake arms. Imagine that. I mean, and you just think about, how could this man think that he was God? That's what really confuses me. I mean, if I had to go to the costumes shop and buy two, you know, plastic arms and stick them on, how could I really believe I was God? You know, we've done a lot of dramas where we have Lord Brahma in the drama. I mean, not actually Lord Brahma. That would be pretty fun, right? Imagine if you had a drama and Lord Brahma shows up and says, hi, I'm here to play myself. But we would have one of the devotees play Lord Brahma. And so we would have this kind of thing they would wear on their head, where there were another three heads, right, and crowns. But the other heads don't do anything, because they're just made out of plastic or styrofoam or something like that. So if somebody puts this on their face, and then they believe that they actually have four heads, and they're actually Lord Brahma, that's pretty strange. So imagine if you just like went to a mannequin in a shop. You know what a mannequin is? The plastic people that they put the clothes on in the shop. You go to the shop and you see these like sculptures of people, right? And they're wearing the clothes. Sometimes the sculptures don't have any heads or arms. They're just like a plastic body. But sometimes they have heads, and sometimes the heads, there's not really a face. Right. So if you went to one of those and you just like cut off the arms and then you arrange some contraption, like you had some kind of jumper that you wore, you know, maybe it was made out of metal or something like that, and you stuck these plastic arms onto it and you wore it, it would kind of be this heavy thing, right? It'd be kind of hard to fight in. Also, he's there on the battlefield and he's got this funky thing with these fake arms. I mean, I would imagine you're trying to shoot your arrows and the arms kind of get in the way, and I don't know. Maybe sometimes you hurt the other soldiers with the arms. So these fake arms. And then in these arms he had a conch shell and a disc and a club and a lotus flower. Now, in the fake arms, he just had to have them, like, stuck onto the arms. So it's just this, you know, fake arm with this lotus flower just kind of stuck there. And he has this fake Sudarshan disc, you know, in this club. Oh, and then Krishna has this Srivatsa mark on his chest. And a Kastuba jewel. The Kastuba jewel looks like a little calf. And it says, all of us living entities are resting in this Kastuba jewel. So we can think about that for a moment. That we're all kind of sitting on this Kastuba jewel right now. Like right now on the Lord's chest. It's kind of interesting to think about that. And the Srivatsa, that's where Lakshmi is. So she's always with the Lord. You know, in this world, if a husband and wife really love each other, they usually only really love each other this much in the first couple of years. But if a husband and wife really, really love each other, they might never want to be away from each other. They might want to be with each other all the time. But that's not exactly very practical. Right? I mean, Prabhupada has this purport where he says, the wife should always be embraced by the husband and always be on the chest of the husband, embraced by the husband. And I thought, well, Prabhupada uses the word always, but that it doesn't seem very practical. You know, you're going to walk around all the time hugging your wife. I just don't see how you kind of manage to do life. You know, how do you go to work? How do you drive your car? I guess you have to have a driver for your car. You have to have a cook. And someone else would have to work for you. I don't know. So I don't think Prabhupada literally means always. But Lakshmi wants to always be on the chest of Narayan. She wants to always be embraced by Narayan. So she stays there as a hare. And that way she's always with her Lord. She's never separated from him. And these two marks, the Srivatsa on the Lord's chest and the Kastuba jewel, they indicate Lord Vishnu and not one of Lord Vishnu's devotees. You know, when Gopakumara goes to the spiritual world, when he goes to Vaikuntha, he first sees one of the gatekeepers. And he says, oh, Narayana, Lord Vishnu. Om Namo Narayanaya. And the doorkeeper says, no, 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 no. I am his servant. Gopakumara's like, oh, sorry. And then he sees another devotee who looks just like Vishnu. And again he says, oh, Namo Narayanaya. Oh, my Lord, my Lord. And the servant goes, no, 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 I'm just a servant. And this happens over and over and over and over. And Gopakumara is going through all these gates. There's 7 gates to Vaikuntha. And each gate, there's doorkeepers that look just like Lord Vishnu. And each time, Gopakumara, oh, Narayana! They go, no, no, no. And finally, one of them says, look, let me tell you how you can tell who's Narayana. He has a Srivatsa mark, and he's wearing a Kastuba jewel. None of us have that. We all look exactly like Narayana, except we don't have that. So Pandraka made sure that he had the Srivatsa and the Kastuba, but it wasn't a real Kastuba jewel. It was a fake one. Like you can go to a jewelry store and buy a real diamond, or you can buy a cubic zirconia, which sort of looks like a diamond, but isn't. And you could even just buy glass that sort of a little bit sort of looks like a diamond, but isn't at all. Right? And if somebody doesn't know what a diamond looks like, they might be fooled by the glass or fooled by the cubic zirconia. But anyone who knows would immediately say, well, no, that's not real. So I'm sure some of you, I don't know, I haven't watched any Indian movies for a long, long, long time. But it used to be when I ran the Gurukul that we would show the old, old, old movies of the Ramayana and Mahabharata, those old, old, old movies. I'm sure you've all seen them, right? Where people move really slowly. And in one episode, they only cover 5 minutes of plot. You know, it's like a 45-minute episode, and only 5 minutes of plot happen. And where they have these arrows, right? These cartoon arrows that just, you know, you've got like a whole minute where there's just these two cartoon arrows going So they also have all these really fake props. So the actors in these movies, they have these crowns that look just like aluminum foil. Right? And they have those sort of headgear with the other heads that don't move or anything like that. I guess, you know, if you've never seen a Hollywood movie, then it's okay. But they have all these things that are just completely fake looking. So Pandraka looked like that. It looked like he came out of a bad, bad, bad Bollywood movie, you know? And he also had a long garland of forest flowers, you know, like down to his knees. And he was wearing a yellow silk dhoti. And he had makara earrings. Do you know what makaras are?
Shark or fish.
Well, sometimes Prabhupada translates it as shark or dolphin. But actually, it's a creature that we don't see on this planet. And it's the carrier of Ganga. It's the carrier of Cupid. And it's kind of a mix between a crocodile and a dragon and all these other creatures. And it lives in the water. So Krishna likes to wear earrings that look like a makara. And so he was this Pandraka. I mean, he'd studied Krishna very minutely so he could copy him. And again, the funniest thing to me is that he thought that he was the real thing. You know? If I've got to buy fake arms and I've got to glue the lotus onto the arms and I have to go to the, you know, cheap Bollywood movie costume shop and get my Kastuba jewel, then I must know that I'm a fake. And somehow he didn't know that he was a fake. And this is what's really interesting, because I think for all of us conditioned souls, we have problems that are very obvious to everyone but ourselves. Isn't this a fact? Right? I mean, all of us know that we can see the problems of the people that we know. But they can't see them. And we'll, sometimes if we know them well, or if we're very foolish, we try to tell other people what their problems are. Have you ever done that? Try to tell other people what their problems are? It's not very effective. Even when they ask you, even when they say, please tell me what my problems are, I have found that if you actually believe them and you start to tell them what their problems are, that the result is not very favorable. So, and that's true even if it's completely obvious to everybody. It's like completely obvious. So I think we all have this problem to some extent, that someone else looks at us and goes, really? And we're going, yeah, really. So that was it was like with Pandraka. And Jiva Goswami quotes from the Uttarakhand of the Padma Purana, saying that Lord Shiva had given this Pandraka a benediction that he be able to dress up like Lord Vishnu. So Krishna sees him, and now Krishna laughs. So in the Sudharma assembly house, all the other devotees were laughing, and Krishna was really enjoying it. But now Krishna's just, he was just could not stop laughing. And, you know, I thought about this because the mentality of the devotee should be that they just want to make Krishna smile. They just want to make Krishna happy. Prabhupada says the gopis, their only desire in life is that Krishna should smile. And Pandraka made Krishna not smile, but just laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. So again, he brought a lot of happiness to Krishna, although that wasn't his intention. So then Pandraka and his armies, they attack Krishna, and they attack Krishna with tridents, with clubs, with bludgeons. I'm not quite sure what a bludgeon is as different from a club. I think it's just kind of a big stick that doesn't have a bulbous thing at the end. With pikes. I think a pike is something like a spear. With rishtis, which are kind of sword. With barbed darts. So do you kids know what a barb is? Hey, do you guys know what a barb is? Like barbed wire, but also a barbed dart. So a dart is sharp, and then it has a barb that goes the other way. And what happens when you have something sharp, but it has a barb that goes the other way, I don't know how to do this, that goes the other way, is when it goes in you, you can't pull it out. Like if you have an arrow that goes in your body, you can pull it out. But if there's a dart with a barb, it's pointed in both directions. So when people go fishing, that's what they do. The fish hooks that the fishermen use to catch fish and kill fish, it's like that. It's got a hook, and then it's got a bar going the other way. So I know this because when we lived at the temple in Detroit, there was a cat that had tried to eat a dead fish that had been caught by a fisherman and still had the hook with the barbed dart inside the fish's mouth. So when the cat went to eat the fish, the cat got this hook inside of its mouth. And the poor cat was in terrible, terrible pain. So my oldest son, I can't remember how old he was at the time. I'm thinking he was probably around 8 or 9 years old. He didn't ask anybody. He just felt sorry for the cat. And he picked up the cat and got the hook out of the cat's mouth. Well, guess what happened to the hook? So it went, first it was put in the fish, then it went in the cat, and then where do you think it went? In his hand. So he got the barb in his finger. And we couldn't pull it out because it's sharp both ways. So you can't make it go anywhere. We had to go to the hospital. We had to take it out of the hospital. So they were shooting Krishna with these barbed darts and with lances. Now, I'm not exactly sure what the difference is between a pike and a lance. I'm not a weapons person. I know we need like a weapons expert here. And with swords, but it also already mentioned wristies, which is a kind of sword. So I'm not sure what the difference is between a sword and a wristie. Maybe one of them is a straight sword and one of them is like a curved sword, like a scimitar. And with axes. Now, I don't know why people are bringing axes to a battlefield. But yeah, Parasaram uses an axe. That's his favorite weapon, is an axe. And you see sometimes like Durga Devi has an axe. But it seems like a strange weapon for a battlefield. I think of axes as to cut down trees, you know, and chop wood, and not really as a battlefield weapon. But they use axes and also arrows. Okay? Does anybody remember what some of those weapons are?
Bludgeon,
barbed darts. What else?
Wristies.
Spears.
Mace.
Arrows. Okay. Then, so they, all these weapons are being thrown at Krishna, and of course at Krishna's army. But then Krishna, it said, attacked so vigorously that he tormented everybody in the opposing army, and it said it was like the fire at the end of the creation torments all the living entities. So even the scientists say that there will be a time in the universe when the sun gets super, super hot and the whole solar system just burns up. So a similar statement is there in the Vedas, that at the end of the creation, which is not just the end of the solar system but the whole universe, that everything gets super, 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 super hot. And of course everybody then is suffering terribly. So the Krishna made all the soldiers suffer terribly like this. Now then the battlefield looked like a playground. But not with swings and slides. It looked like the playground of a particular person. Anyone have any idea whose playground it looked like? That's a very good guess. And you're very close actually. Because Virabhadra was associated with the person.
Shiva.
Shiva. So it looked like Shiva's playground. And Shiva's in charge of destruction. So when Shiva has a playground, right, it's not like swings and slides and a merry-go-round. And it's just ghastly. So that's one of the rasas. One of the rasas is ghastliness. Horror. Disgust. And you could say, well, that doesn't seem like a very nice rasa. But actually, even in this world, people try to enjoy a perversion of a ghastly rasa. There's so many movies made of people getting chopped up and like that. One of my experiences that convinced me that I need to actually like fully join the Hare Krishna movement and not try to practice Krishna consciousness on my own. This is kind of an embarrassing story. So I was 17, and I had already decided that I wanted to be a devotee of Krishna. And so I was chanting, I was offering my food, I was reading Prabhupada's books, I was following the principles. And I was still going to university. And so there were these two girls who lived in my dormitory, and they said, you know, on your 18th birthday, you have to come with us and see an R-rated movie. And I said, well, I'm not really watching movies anymore. But anyway, they kept pressuring me and pressuring me and pressuring me. You have to come see this R-rated movie when you're 18. And I thought these were nice girls. They weren't like wild people. I thought they were nice people. Anyway, so they took me to this horror movie. It was the first time and the last time in my life I've ever seen a horror movie. And I knew why I never saw horror movies before that. And it was about some woman who went around killing people with an axe, actually. And it tormented me. For years I would have nightmares about this movie. It was just terrific. And I couldn't understand why anybody would want to go see some movie of people getting cut up and blood everywhere. Anyway, that experience convinced me that I needed to be with devotees, that I couldn't live with the non-devotees, that if I was with the non-devotees, that they would convince me to do stupid things that I would regret. And so I said, I better go move into the ashram and live with the devotees. But anyway, people enjoy these. Again, it's not my taste, but people get some pleasure out of it. And Prabhupada talked about how he saw one time this man getting pleasure from killing chickens and seeing the chickens running around, jumping around without their heads. He said that he's trying to enjoy the ghastly rasa. So when you try to enjoy ghastly rasa in the material world, it's ghastly. It's awful. But there is some actual enjoyment. You know, and you can see that people have, at least some people, have a tendency, right? Or I think even most of us, if someone says, ew, look at that, that's disgusting, we go, oh, let me see. I think all of us have a little bit of a tendency like that. Right? But there is a ghastly rasa, that there's some pleasure in this, you know, blood everywhere and severed heads and arms and legs and dead horses and dead elephants, and, you know, all broken chariots and just total devastation. I guess we do this a little bit when we're children and we like to build things and break them, right? You like to build the little people out of Legos and then take the heads off?
Yeah.
Right? That's a little bit of the same kind of thing. So Krishna's enjoying this. And it says not only Krishna enjoyed this, but the Bhagavatam says that wise and enlightened people also took pleasure in this ghastly scene. So why do you think wise and enlightened people thought that this was enjoyable? Because, yes, it's related to Krishna. And Krishna's enjoying it. And it's killing these people who are causing a disturbance. You know, the destruction of something that's causing a disturbance and giving pleasure to the Lord. Now, Krishna, first of all, he just destroys this army and creates this playground of Lord Shiva. And then he says to Pandraka, all right, you asked me to give you my... my Sudarshan Chakra and my weapons, here you go. Now I'm going to do it. He says, unless you give up the false use of my name. And he says, I'll tell you what, you asked me to be your shelter, so if you defeat me, I'll be your shelter. So then Krishna took out an arrow, and I found this really interesting. With his arrow, he destroyed Pandraka's chariot. How do you destroy a chariot with an arrow? It must have been a mystic arrow. It must have had some subtle power. Or maybe just because Krishna shot it. So it's not really explained. Is it just that Krishna shoots an arrow and it can destroy a whole chariot? Or is it some kind of mystic arrow? And then he takes out Sudarshan and he cuts off Pandraka's head. Then Sudarshan also cuts off the head of the king of Kashi. And Sudarshan takes the head of the king of Kashi and carries it over the wall of Kashi and deposits Kashi Raj's head right inside the wall. Now, the acharyas say that morning before Kashi Raj went out to fight, the king had many queens and he wanted to impress them, which is very typical in this world, right, that men want to impress women, especially their wife. So the king had said to his queens, I'm going to cut off Krishna's head on the battlefield and I'm going to throw that head over the wall into the city. So that's why Sudarshan did this. So then Krishna was done. He decimated the army. He killed Pandraka and Kashi Raj. He's done. So he goes back to Dwarka. And when Krishna goes back to Dwarka, the perfected beings in the higher planets are praising him and showering him with flowers. And Pandraka, this is very interesting, Pandraka was always meditating on Krishna's form. So yam yam bhapi smram bhavam, whatever we meditate on, we get. So because he was meditating on Krishna's form, he got swarupya mukti. He got a form in Vaikuntha like Lord Vishnu. He got to be one of those beings in Vaikuntha that someone like Gopal Kumar kept thinking he was Vishnu. You see, that's what he wanted. He wanted people to think he was Vishnu. So he ends up getting a form where somebody will say, Om Namo Narayanaya, and then he goes, no, I'm not Vishnu. How interesting. Now, you might say, but he was offensive. He was demoniac. So although he was meditating like that, it was demoniac. But Krishna killing him removed him of offenses. And so all that was left was that meditation. So, of course, these stories are there to say to us, what to speak if you meditate on Krishna. So if Pandraka, by meditating on Krishna in this offensive and, I think, ridiculous way, ended up going to the Vaikuntha planets, then what to speak if we meditate on Krishna properly, in a loving way? Then surely we will get a spiritual body and go to Krishna's abode. So meanwhile, King of Kashi's head is there. Krishna's back in Dwarka, and he's, you know, takes a bath, changes his clothes, and he's done. So Kashi Raj's head has gone over the wall of Kashi, of the kingdom of Kashi, and it's there, and nobody knows what it is. So this also interested me, that no one knew what it was. They didn't at first recognize it at all as a head. Now, I don't know why. It was bloody, maybe? You know, it must have been really gory. Maybe blood and maybe the brains come out, and I don't know, you know. It must have been something really, just didn't look human head-like. And then they're wondering, what is this strange thing? And eventually someone notices that it has earrings. And when they notice it has earrings, they say, oh, it's a head. And then it was remembered that morning Kashi Raj had said that he was going to throw Krishna's head over the wall into the city. And so they said, oh, it must be Krishna's head. So they start looking at it very carefully, and then they see, oh, wait a minute, this is our king's head. And then the queens come out and they're crying. So this is the very typical that, you know, the demons get the opposite result of what they desire. And Prahlad Maharaj said this also. He said that, you know, we invariably will get the opposite result to what we desire. Now, another very interesting thing that happens here is that the king of Kashi had a son named Sudakshina. Now, I assume he had more than one son. He had more than one wife. Let's assume that he had more than one son. But at least he had this one son who became very, very angry when he saw that Krishna had killed his father. And he decided that Krishna was a murderer, which doesn't make any sense at all. It was a battle, and it was a battle we could say that was instigated by Pandraka. Even though Krishna went to Kashi, Krishna brought his armies to Kashi and attacked Kashi. He attacked Kashi because he was instigated by this messenger from Pandraka who said, give me your weapons. So we could really say it was started by Pandraka and Kashi Raj. And in any case, it was a battle. And when someone's killed in a battle, that's not considered murder. It's just never considered murder. So, you know, Kashi Raj came out with 3 Akshahini divisions. Now, if Kashi had come out with a white flag and say, I surrender, and then Krishna had killed him, then that would be murder. But he comes out fighting Krishna. So certainly that's not murder. So for Sudakshina to take this view that Krishna had killed his father unjustly and that Krishna should be punished for it certainly isn't by any sort of Kshatriya code or even by any code of modern warfare. You know, even in our present very degraded time, nobody would understand this to be murder. But that's how Sudakshina took it. Now, Sudakshina is described by the Bhagavatam as being very charitable. So that's also interesting. Because, of course, it says in the Bhagavatam that the non-devotees have no good qualities. And yet sometimes we see that they do have good qualities, and they're praised for having good qualities. In fact, I'm sure that we can find some non-devotee that has more good qualities than some. If we just take a particular devotee and a particular non-devotee, we would find that there would be some good qualities that the non-devotee has that the devotee may not have. But why do we say the non-devotees have no good qualities? Because ultimately they're selfish. And because of being selfish, if they're threatened enough, they jettison their good qualities. So even though Sudakshina was very charitable and probably very good as a ruler and as royalty in general, when his father was killed, he gave up his good qualities. And he really acted in a way that was contrary to the codes of morality and the codes of government. And he decided that I'm going to kill Krishna and I'm going to destroy Dwarka. Now keep in mind at this point that there had not been an attack on the city of Kashi itself. So this was an attack that went on outside the walls. It was a walled city. It went on outside the walls, and it only went on with the soldiers who came out of the city. You know, when Krishna brought his armies to Kashi, if Kashi Raj and Pandraka had come out and said, oh, we're really sorry, please forgive us, we surrender, nobody would have been killed at all. Nobody would have been hurt, but they came out aggressively with their armies. But Krishna didn't do anything to the citizens of Kashi. But Sudakshina decides that he is going to destroy the whole city of Dwarka. So he's not waging war now. You know, and this is also very interesting because he decides that Krishna acted improperly, that Krishna did murder rather than war, and his response to that is he's going to act improperly and he's going to attack the citizens rather than... he could have had another battle. He could have gotten more armies together and gone to Dwarka with an army and had another battle army to army, but that's not what he does. So he prays to Lord Shiva, who's basically the main deity worshipped in Kashi. Now, Lord Shiva appears and he says, I'll give you whatever you want. Now, Lord Shiva knows that this Sudakshina is demoniac and Sudakshina is an enemy of Krishna. So he actually gives Sudakshina a benediction that he knows is going to kill Sudakshina. So Sudakshina says, I want a benediction that I can kill my enemy. And so Lord Shiva says, all right, well, I'll tell you how to do it. He doesn't give the benediction directly. He says, you worship the Dakshin Agni fire through black arts. You have to get some brahmanas who are expert in the black arts and worship the Dakshin Agni fire. And then you can produce a creature who will kill anyone you want except for someone who's a brahmana or who likes brahmanas. So Sudakshina thought, well, okay, Krishna is definitely not a brahmana. He's a kshatriya. And he doesn't like the brahmanas. Now, why would anyone decide that Krishna doesn't like the brahmanas? Because generally the kshatriyas are supposed to worship and respect the brahmanas. But because Krishna is God, sometimes the brahmanas would offer respect and worship to him. And he would accept it. So a kshatriya is not supposed to accept worship from a brahmana. Right? I mean, even today in Indian society, you don't have the juniors blessing the seniors. Right? No, you can't do that. Even, what I like to do is if someone offers me obeisances, I want to offer obeisances back to them. So I was in Hungary and Shiva Ramar said to me, Ermila, you have to stop offering obeisances to your juniors. It's not proper etiquette. And I said, but I don't see them as that. I see them as Vaishnavas. He says, it doesn't matter. He said, you can offer pranams, but don't offer obeisances. I'm following his instructions with great regret. But this was the mood. It always bothers me. It's like, but I want to offer obeisances. Why aren't I allowed to offer obeisances? Right? This was the mood. So Sudakshina he engages these brahmanas. And he says, okay, we're going to kill Krishna because Krishna doesn't respect the brahmanas. He lets the brahmanas worship him. And so we're going to create this demon. So these priests agree to this, which makes them also guilty. And they're offering these black tantric rituals. Okay? So when they do this, this being comes out of... Oh, and Lord Shiva said, my ghost will also help. So this being comes out of the fire. The fire, or you could say the fire itself, took this form of this humongous man. Not really a man, a male creature. And he was naked, and he was as big as like a huge, huge palm tree. And his hair and beard and mustache looked like molten copper. So like this bright, bright, bright orange hair. And cinders were coming out of his eyes. So little bits of hot coals were coming out of his eyes, like hot lava. And he had these huge fangs. And then he had a trident that was blazing like fire. Actually, no, just his legs were as tall as palm trees, so he was a lot taller. And he was shaking the ground. And everywhere he went, fires would just go everywhere. And then Lord Shiva had sent to accompany this being these pramita ghosts. And pramita ghosts are shapeshifters. So they can just take whatever shape they want, different fearful shapes. And they were kind of like mystics, but subtle mystics. So now this huge creature with this blazing trident and these fangs and these cinders coming out of his eyes, and he's shaking, he's like creating practically like earthquakes, and these shape-shifting mystics, they all go to Dwarka. So Krishna's playing a game. He's playing some game like dice or chess or... And the citizens run in and they say, "Save us, save us, save us!" And Krishna just laughs. And he says, "You know, you're the Yadus. We're afraid of somebody demon-like." And Krishna said, don't worry. You know, don't worry, I'll take care of you." So many times in our life we have some kind of crisis. And most of the time the crises we have are not real crises. You know, like, most of the time the crisis, we, you know, our car won't start and we have a meeting to go to or something like that. We think we have something crises. But even the major, major, major crises in life, you know, from the point of view of eternality, are really nothing. So this was a pretty major crisis. You know, you have this, like, 3 palm trees tall, blazing demoniac creature coming with these shape-shifting mystics into your city. And Krishna took it like, you know, your car won't start. And he was like, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it." And then Krishna didn't want to disrupt his game. You know? He just, "I'm playing the game. I don't want to be disturbed." So he just indicates to Sudarshan, "You go and take care of this." So Sudarshan started blazing like a million suns. And often Sudarshan is compared to the sun itself. But he starts blazing like a million suns at the time of devastation, which is what Krishna was like on the battlefield. So that Krishna was acting like the sun at the end of the creation. But now Sudarshan was doing this. And it says the Bhagavatam that Sudarshan gave pain to the sky, the directions, the earth, and the demon. Now, Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, and I don't know where Prabhupada's getting this from, because it's not clearly in the verse in the Bhagavatam. I couldn't find it in any of the commentaries. Of course, there's one book of commentaries I don't have yet, but so maybe it's there. And Prabhupada wrote that Sudarshan froze this monster. Because it sounded like Sudarshan was super, super, super hot. You know, the demon was hot. The demon was like a fire creature. And it sounded like Sudarshan became a super fire. So you had like this demon who was a big fire, and Sudarshan is like a bigger, 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 bigger fire. But Prabhupada uses the word freezes. And I even went to check on the Krishna book dictation tapes, but that tape has been lost. So I couldn't check, you know, to hear what Prabhupada actually said. But in Krishna book, it says that this demon that Sudarshan froze the demon. Which reminded me of another battle with Banasura, where the Shiva Jwara was hot and the Narayana Jwara was cold. So anyway, Sudarshan, although he looked like all the blazing 10 million suns, somehow to this creature, this Dakshinagni creature, it was cold. And the creature was going to die. The cold was going to kill the creature. So the creature just turns around with all of his pramita ghosts. Now, Prabhupada explains that these sort of mystical black art creatures, once you invoke them, they have to finish what they were invoked to do. But that's even true for other beings. Like we find when Durvasa gave Kunti the mantras to call the demigods. We just saw this play in Mayapur. And she calls the sun god. And he says, "Well, now we have to have a child together." And she's like, no. And he said, "Sorry, once you chant this mantra, I'm actually forced by the mantra. I don't have a choice about it. I have to complete what I'm sent to do." And we find this also with Ramchandra when he's asking Varuna to let them cross. And at one point he puts an arrow in his bow. And when Varuna comes out, Ram says, "I have to shoot this arrow at something now that I've invoked it." It has to finish. So many times we do these sort of things. Many times we set something into motion. And once we set something into motion, we're not able to stop it. You know, it's going to go to its destination. I mean, I think we all like the feature now in some email servers where, you know, you click send and then you can undo. In my email server, I have 2 layers of undo. You know, it gives me 2 choices to unsend it. And I've used those many times. You know, I'll look at it and go, oops. Right? But there's a certain point, once you send it, it's sent. You can't revoke it. Right? And so many of the things that we do in this world are like that. You know, you put something into motion and then, what did I do? And there it's going. So this Dakshinagni creature, once was sent to kill somebody, he was going to kill somebody. So if he couldn't kill Krishna and destroy Dwarka, so he went back and he killed Sudakshina and the priests. And he also burned Varanasi. So this demon burned the halls, the residences, everything. Now Sudarshan followed Dakshinagni demon to Kashi, and Sudarshan was also destroyed. So between this demon creature and Sudarshan, Kashi was destroyed. Now you might say, why was Kashi destroyed? Because Sudakshina wanted to destroy Dwarka. So by wanting to destroy Dwarka, he ended up destroying his own city and his own self. And this is in fact the way that karma works. Whenever we try to harm others, the only person we harm is ourselves. Now you might say, well, you know, it seems that we can harm others. But we can only harm others if they're destined to be harmed by their karma. I don't have the... If I had the ability to hurt you when it wasn't your destiny to be hurt, then I'd be stronger than God. I'd be stronger than the law of karma. You know? So if I punch you in the nose and your nose is bleeding, if I hadn't punched you in the nose, you would have bumped up against the door. You know, Krishna doesn't need me to punch you in the nose. He says, Krishna doesn't require evildoers. Isn't it? Right? So if I'm able to make your nose bleed, that meant that you were destined to have your nose bleed. So who did I actually hurt? Myself. Because I desired to do violence to another being, that violence is going to come back to me. And Prabhupada said, you're such a fool, you don't realize you're really hurting yourself. Yes.
Well, I mean, if you want to reverse that, maybe instead of hurting someone, you can increase them or serve them.
Then that also comes back to you.
You know, that's destined for the other person then.
Yes. Then that's destined for the other person. Which is why if you don't operate transcendentally, you're not really doing anything. Ahankaravi mudhatma, parthahamiti manyate. You're not really doing anything. I mean, in one sense, you're doing something nice for yourself, but even that's an illusion, because it's not the real self. So that's why, basically, when we're working materially, we're not really accomplishing anything. We appear to be accomplishing something, but we're not.
It's interesting how, after Dhruva Maharaj saw Lord himself,
yes,
and then he
had this fight with the Yakshas.
Because they killed his brother, and he...
Yes. Yes, that's... It's interesting, it was, I guess, probably just about a year ago that I was studying that portion of the Bhagavatam with my grandsons in Hawaii, and how Dhruva was fighting against the Yakshas. You know, and you could say it was a similar kind of thing here, that, you know, the Yakshas killed my brother and therefore I'm going to kill all of the Yakshas. And Swayambhuva Manu stopped him. He says, you know, stop killing these innocent Yakshas. Now, of course, also with that case of Dhruva killing the Yakshas, at first Dhruva just went outside their city and blew his conch shell. And the Yakshas could have come out of the city and said, oh, my dear emperor, what do you want? So there didn't have to be a battle. You know, I don't see there that Dhruva fired the first shot. He did blow his conch shell. He did say, I'm here, and he was the emperor. So they really were like, oh, you're coming to attack us. And they really instigated the battle. So in one sense, Dhruva was, he had the right as the emperor to go there and say, hey, you know, turn over the Yaksha who killed my brother. And then he certainly had the right to defend himself. But at a certain point, Swayabhumanda said, you've gone too far. But it is very interesting that even very, very great devotees who've seen the Lord may still sometimes display something that's not quite right and that they need to be corrected. And why is that? You know, sometimes we can say, well, if they're completely on the platform of purity, then this is some sort of lila that's for our instruction. But we can also say that even if somebody is very advanced, there may still be some sort of residual something that needs to be purified. And Krishna doesn't take that very seriously in his advanced devotees. No, but even Bart Marsh had to take another couple births. But Krishna doesn't take it very seriously. Apichetsu Churacharo. I mean, just like even with us, you know, who have, especially those of us who are parents, if one of our children does something that's not exactly right, even if it's pretty outrageous, you know, even if they do something that's pretty outrageous, we don't take their offenses very seriously. We may communicate to them that this is not good, but we still have affection for them. And that's true even when someone commits a crime. You know, many years ago I read about someone who had killed several people, murdered several people, and his father was a police chief. And the father was saying, you know, when his son was caught and put in jail, how as a police chief he was happy he was caught, but as a father he was heartbroken. You know, he still had love for his son. So for the great devotees who mess up, whether they mess up because they still have some anartha or whether they mess up because it's some part of how they're enacting the Lord's pastimes. So Krishna doesn't feel any enmity towards them. Anyway, I thought it was interesting that the whole city became destroyed. You know, that the... And this is also an interesting discussion about karma. You know, that the citizens end up dying and having their city destroyed because their ruler does something foolish. And there was a similar story with, I think his name, Ramachandra Khan, with Lord Nityananda, that when Ramachandra Khan insulted Lord Nityananda, that then his whole family and his whole village were wiped out by the Muslim government. So that our actions also affect others.
Can we say that in that case, you know, like, yes, the way the king is, the subject are, and the way the subject...
Certainly. So. Certainly. And again, if we see that everything's fair, they must have also had some sort of guilt there. But the way we're supposed to think is that my actions affect other people, especially my actions affect my dependents. You know, if I act improperly, my children or my employees or whoever is there is also going to be adversely affected. They're also going to suffer. We shouldn't be thinking, well, if they suffer, it's just their karma, so I can do whatever I want. It doesn't work like that. If I engage in actions that appear to be the cause of someone else's suffering, I am responsible for that even though they're destined to suffer, because I don't have to take the role of the agent of their suffering. It's just like I get good karma if I give in charity to somebody. You know, I use my free will to do something good to someone or something bad to them. So at the end of this chapter, there's a nice verse. Any mortal who recounts this heroic pastime of Lord Uttama Slokas or who simply hears it attentively become free from all sins and all sinful reactions. So bhakti is, and we'll talk about this tomorrow morning, how bhakti is the real means to get free of all of our material sufferings. That material solutions and even other forms of yoga don't root out the root of our suffering. So I hope you...
When we hear so many of this, you know, we still are forced to, you know, like, commit sins, maybe apradha sins, whatever, then get the reactions.
Well, that's something I was thinking of when reading this. You know, I thought, all right, so I read this story again twice today. And I've read it many times, and I've given this class several times. But it still appears that I suffer the reactions of my sins. It appears that way to me. But of course, Rupa Goswami says that as soon as you take to Krishna consciousness, you're not suffering the result of your sins. Now, the way I understand this, it's just like when I ran a school very much based on the individual students. So like in most schools in the world today, with some notable exceptions, if you're 8 years old, you go to the class with the other 8-year-olds and you do whatever all the other 8-year-olds are doing. And if you already know everything in that class, well, too bad. You have to sit and hear it anyway. And if you're way behind and you're just completely lost because you have no idea what's going on, well, too bad on you also. You know, so really the teacher's only hitting the average kids in the class as far as what the teacher is teaching. So the way I ran my school is I would test all the students and I would put them at the level where they were at. And they might be at one level in reading and a different level in math. And so they might be at level 5 in math and level 7 in reading and so forth. But the majority of the time, the majority of the students ended up more or less in the same level that they would be at if they went to a school where they were put by age. So I see it like that. When you surrender to Krishna, it becomes very individualized. Krishna looks at you and says, okay, what do you need? Now, where's our, you know, the reactions to our sins? Why do we get reactions to our sins? Because the mentality needs to be rectified. I committed a sin because I had a sinful mentality. Now, when I come to Krishna consciousness, some of my sinful mentality may immediately be gone. It doesn't need to be rectified. It's just gone as soon as I come to Krishna consciousness. You know, many people who come to Krishna consciousness used to eat non-vegetarian food, and then that mentality that caused them to eat non-veg food is gone. So why should they have to suffer for that? They don't. But suppose I've given up the sinful activity, but I still have that mentality. I haven't given up the mentality. So I may need to get some kind of experience that would be very, very similar to the experience I would get by karma. Except it's done by Krishna. It's not really a sinful reaction. It's Krishna's working with me very personally. And as soon as Krishna sees that the mentality is rectified, then Krishna removes that. So I see it's not exactly a sinful reaction. It's on a different level. I mean, if we commit sins knowingly, intentionally, as devotees, then yeah, we may get a sinful. Although even then, Krishna is dealing with us personally. And then we also get reactions for offenses. And I've seen in our Hare Krishna movement, even very advanced devotees get reactions for offenses. It's quite interesting. I mean, I really find it quite interesting. And sometimes you can look at it and you can see, oh, wow, they did this and they had this and it was the same kind of thing. I'm thinking of examples, but I'm worried that if I give examples and this is recorded, that somebody will know who I'm talking about, and so I kind of prefer not to. But, you know, I'll try to be as vague as possible. You know, I've seen, like, person A will accuse person B unjustly. And person A will get accused unjustly of the very same thing by somebody else, by person C. I've seen that. I've seen it happen several times. Or, you know, person A is unjustly accusing person B. Person C knows it's unjust and they don't say anything. Then person C gets accused unjustly. So I've seen that. Or, you know, somebody refuses to give support to some service that they're supposed to give support to. It's in their jurisdiction. It's their area of service. They're supposed to take care of some devotees. They're supposed to take care of some project. That's their, you could say, their job. And they don't do it. Then I see later on they're forced to do it in another circumstance. Or somebody doesn't support them when they need to be supported. So, and I've just seen it happen. I mean, with devotees, it tends to happen very quickly. You know, karmic reactions, maybe you would do it in 200 lifetimes. For devotees, you see it happens, you know, sometimes days or months or years. So, I mean, just recently, I was witnessing a couple devotees who were really causing trouble for another devotee. And I said to one of them, wouldn't hear me, so I didn't bother, but I said to one of them very strongly, I said, you are going to get a reaction for doing this. I see it all the time. Please stop. And I said, the reaction may not only come to you, it may come to your family. I said, what you're doing right now is of such nature that you will definitely get a reaction. And the reaction will probably affect people that you love. It's probably not just going to affect you. I'm telling you. I said it like 5 times. Anyway, they didn't listen to a word that I said, which was very painful for me. I was like, you know, I really don't want to see you suffer for doing this. I'm not going to get any pleasure from knowing, from being able to say, I told you so, a year from now. And I've seen the same thing happen to me. You know, I don't have time tonight, but I mean, I've seen it happen to me where, especially if I keep getting some circumstance and then I pray to Krishna and I said, please Krishna, tell me if I've ever done this to someone else. And then he reveals to me that I have and I'm like, oops. So I do see that, especially if we mistreat devotees. Especially that. That. And when it comes back to us, we may not understand that it's coming back to us because we don't see what we did wrong. So I hope you all enjoyed the story.